and I'm Alexia Ridley. Last year, complaints arose over EMS response times in Clark County. County commissioners and citizens alike have criticized National EMS, the company that provides ambulance services for both of Athens' hospitals, for slow response times. The hospitals say that the data is being misrepresented. Here to talk about that and the rest of the weekend news and politics is our panel of commentators. Joining me today is Gwen O'Looney with WXAG, Chris Dowd, editor of Athens Politics Nerd, and Blake Odd with Flagpole. Last year, local activists and elected officials brought forward concerns that National EMS was not meeting contractually obligated response times during emergency calls. Those same voices also criticized National for being less than transparent about the data. Now, attention on this issue was renewed with a county commission work session examining the topic last month. What would you say the central argument here is for both sides?
It's just like Mark Twain said, you know, I mean, lies, damn lies, and statistics. I mean, who's telling the truth here, you know? I mean, we got two different sets of numbers, and I don't know which one is the right one. You know, Chris has been involved in Athens for Everyone, and they filed an open records request and got a whole bunch of data from the State Department of Public Health, I believe.
That's right.
And that seemed to indicate that they were not meeting their response times. I think they were about 2 or 3 minutes over on average. But the National EMS said, no, you know, this includes non-emergency calls too. And I don't know the difference. And the information that the hospitals presented to the commission at the work session last month seemed to indicate that they were meeting their goals or very, very close to it. And the hospitals were very happy with the service they were providing. But with the oversight committee meetings being closed to the public and the data not being available to the public, there's really just no way to tell.
Well, the data that Athens for Everyone got, that includes both Priority 1 and Priority 2 calls. Now, they're all emergency calls. But the Priority 1 are, you know, the most critical ones where they're running red lights and sirens to try to get there, you know, as fast as possible.
And where do they stand on those?
Well, that data they presented at the recent work session, it was a few weeks ago, and that's the one where they showed that it was about 88%, where they're supposed to be at 90% under 8 minutes and 59 seconds. So, I mean, that may be true as far as I know. Athens for Everyone is unable to distinguish, because we don't have the reason why the person called 911 on our spreadsheet, the data that we got. And so we've been asking for that. I keep saying we. I'm actually not with them anymore,
right.
So I shouldn't say we.
You were at the time, I'm sorry.
At the time I was,
that's
right.
Right. Well, so, you know, I think a lot of times when we write the bids for these services, we are not as conscientious sometimes about seeking out the expertise and defining our supervisory categories, data we request, how it should be kept. And we're in a time when we can do that data in a way that we can answer these questions better. And I think that that's one of the responsibilities of writing the specifications for this service, is how we oversee it. But I think the real question is, why do we feel like we're having to use our fire department to fill the gap between EMS and National and first responders?
Well, the fire department can get there faster because they have 9 fire stations.
Locations, right.
And there are only 2, I believe, ambulance locations in the county. So most of the time the fire department is going to get there first. But they only go out on calls that are, I think they go out on wrecks, obviously fires, but wrecks and heart attacks. They don't go out on all calls.
They go out on 45% of their calls in 2018, mm-hmm. according to Chief Scarborough's annual report,
right.
were medical.
They do go out on some medical calls, but not all.
I don't know.
There's a dispatcher. When you call 911, you're actually calling the police station.
Right.
And this is part of the issue, too, is the fact that when you call 911, you call the police station. The police station has to, the dispatcher at the police station has to decide whether they're going to dispatch fire. And then they also have to decide whether they're going to dispatch an ambulance. And then you get transferred to National EMS, and you have to tell your story all over again
right.
once you get transferred. So there's been a proposal from the police department to streamline this so that the police dispatcher will have more medical knowledge and can directly dispatch the ambulance without having to transfer the call.
Right.
So that would shave a little bit of time off. Well,
and that's overdue.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, that's been.
Yeah, that should have been happening.
That's a 2-year-old idea, probably.
And should have been implemented, right?
It sounded like all the commissioners were on board for that. So hopefully that'll happen relatively soon.
Right.
You just mentioned priority calls. What's a priority two?
A priority two is something that they consider, less. It's not as urgent as a heart attack or a stroke or something like that. And so they don't even, run their sirens. They don't have cars pull over for them.
It could be, something like
somebody
stubbed their toe,
right?
Or it could even just be a transport. Like Glenn was saying, they do a lot of medical transports, which actually is how they pay the bills.
Right.
Because that sort of subsidizes the emergency operations. They get paid a lot more when they're doing
insurance.
Things like transferring people between hospitals and things of that nature.
Right.
Patrick Davenport? I'm sorry, Commissioner Davenport.
Right.
He really had an issue with this when it seemed like
his mother
so long to come for his mother. Didn't he end up taking his mother himself?
Yeah, he did.
Mm-hmm.
He did.
Right.
Yeah, that's really concerning to me.
Right.
So I have a theory about what's happening here. And my theory is that this assumes that no one is lying. Everyone is telling the truth. So I think the data that National presented is actually right for the priority one calls. What I worry about is how they're deciding between priority one and priority two, and are they, putting some calls that are actually kind of important into the priority two so they don't have to report it. I still think they should report those too, but
there are still people who say that they're prioritizing the medical transports, which are much more lucrative over 911 calls, and they're pulling ambulances off out of service in order to do the medical transports.
That's right. And I talked to Mayor Dodd Farrell today of Winterville because, like Patrick Davenport had his problem out there. That's an area where we have a huge gap, a voluntary fire department, and, they are far away from the hospital, so they're very important. We don't have enough ambulance locations, let's admit it. And I think we need to, as citizens, we need to say, why should we be paying our fire department and our ambulance service to cover ambulance service? We need to take, when a long time ago, ambulance service was under the responsibility of the hospitals, and it's a medical service. I think we really need to work with the hospitals to take more responsibility.
This changed 10 years ago when the hospitals decided that they couldn't afford it anymore.
Right.
And they were going to privatize it. And it subsidized, I believe $400,000. I think it's 100 each from Athens-Clarke County, Coney County, St. Mary's, and Athens Regional. So it's much less expensive for the hospitals to do it this way. But again, you don't have the oversight. You don't have
the connection, the expertise,
the control over it.
Right.
And it turns out
accountability.
I mean, maybe medically speaking, and as far as using our resources, maybe we're doing it the best way that we can do it right now for the resources. But what I worry about is that it's not being done openly. They're making these decisions behind closed doors. They're not letting people know. And people call the ambulance, and they're expecting it to show up quickly. When it doesn't, they get obviously very upset, and they lose confidence in the ambulance. And then that's even if they're doing things right, they need to bring us into the conversation.
And I might actually need to push this issue a little more because I have my doubts about whether they can actually keep those oversight meetings closed.
It may be illegal.
Two public hospitals that are nonprofits that get funding from the government, and then two government entities are involved. I think there would be a pretty strong case to make that those should be open meetings.
Absolutely.
Let me ask this, Blake. They're not personnel or real estate.
Right.
No.
These are public.
There are open meetings laws.
But what the hospitals are claiming is that because National EMS is a private company and they have proprietary data, but they're the only private entity that's involved in these meetings. You have four public entities whose meetings are, and you can go to a hospital board meeting. Those are open meetings because they get over a third of their funding from the government, and that makes them open. So, and obviously local government meetings are open. So I wonder about that.
Right. Well, I'll tell you, it's just like any other issue. Transparency helps immediately move any issue more toward credibility. And this issue needs to have credibility. It has safety involved. It has huge budgeting problems. So I think we've learned a lot, and we need to put it in place.
We're going to have to take a break here. And when our panel returns after the break, we'll talk about controversy involving the ACLU of Georgia and an Athens school.
WUGA supports the educational mission of the University of Georgia. Internships are available each semester in radio programming, production, news, and social media for students currently enrolled in college-level study. Information at WUGA.org or 706-542-3324.
This is Athens News Matters. I'm Alexia Ridley with our panel of commentators, and we are joined by Blake Odd, Chris Dowd, and Gwen O'Looney. Thanks again for being here, everyone. And I did want to talk about the ACLU of Georgia issuing a statement regarding the Athens Prayer Network and Gaines Elementary School. Apparently, they offered to pray for the school and were met. The principal, Luther McDaniel, offered a letter of support for the prayer network, and that was posted to a Facebook page, I believe, and it even invited local pastors to participate in the event. And so, of course, it's the ACLU. It's a public school. They had some concerns about it. What are your thoughts about this happening at the school and the response?
Well, the event has been apparently either canceled or moved. I'm not sure, but it's not going to be held at Gaines School anymore. And Dr. McDaniel has said that he regretted sending his invitation out, and I think he realizes he overstepped his bounds. So that's a good outcome. But, you know, I just got to say personally, you know, growing up where I grew up, I mean, I grew up in small town Alabama, and being a Catholic, you know, I mean, it's not fun being a religious minority in the South. Seeing this, I mean, it really kind of took me back to childhood and, you know, kind of, you know, being harassed by a lot of people who were sort of the dominant religion, I guess. So, I mean, it's really just, you just can't do this kind of thing. You know, you just cannot do it. I mean, you can't have religion anywhere near schools. And this is the first time I've seen anything like this happen in Clark County, and I really hope I never see it again, because I think that, you know, people in this community, although I've seen a lot of support for it, a really surprising amount of support from people in Athens for this kind of prayer event. But this is just not the kind of thing that you can do, especially in a community like Athens that's so diverse.
Right. And we hope every single type of church prays for our schools and wants the best for our schools. But the reality is that any time you start mixing, 26% of Americans say that they do not believe in a religion. And that's a lot of people. That's a quarter of our population. I don't know what it is for Athens, but I bet that it's about equivalent. We have a very active atheist group here. So I think that we have to recognize that everyone in their own way needs to pray or support or cheer for our schools. But
to have the leader of the school promote this on school grounds, I think that's clearly out of line.
Right. I don't think he thought. Yeah. He did not think.
That's probably a good way to put it.
Yeah.
Well, seems like it's been resolved before it became a real contentious issue.
And I will also add that, you know, I know a lot of people who have kids in Whitehead Road Elementary, where Dr. McDaniel was the principal up until a few months ago. And I don't know him, but I know that the people I know who send their kids to Whitehead think he did a great job at Whitehead.
Yeah.
And, you know, people at Gaines are very excited that he's coming to Gaines. So,
yeah.
You know, I hope that we can just put this behind us. Right. And, you know, this is a school that is on the governor's list. You know, I mean, it is the lowest performing school in Clark County by test scores. And so, you know, I mean, we need to turn it around. I don't think a public prayer is probably the way to go about doing that.
Right. Well, we'll move on to the fact that our district attorney, Ken Malden, has said that he would not be running for election at the end of his fifth term. The election for a new DA will be held in 2020. And the Western Circuit includes Athens, Clark, and Oconee counties. Malden was elected in 2000 after defeating longtime incumbent Harry Gordon. So, what would you say his legacy is after nearly 20 years in office? Because he had quite a role there.
I will say that I really appreciate him letting us know of his retirement early and offering this decision to the voters rather than an appointment by the governor. I think that was a very considerate move. I dealt with Ken when he was Solicitor General for 8 years of my term. And, you know, the federal program for victim assistance came in just as he was coming in, and he's done a great job with that program. But actually, most of the programs that have come in have been from the judges, and they've played a good role. It's going to be interesting. Deborah Gonzalez, I think she saw him as weak and claimed very early the run against him. So and that'll be interesting.
Well, the climate has changed so much in regards to criminal justice, and I think, you know, Ken Walden is more of an old-school DA, tough on crime, you know, kind of rhetoric. And I hear from a lot of defense lawyers I know that, you know, they think that he tends to overcharge a lot of cases, and Deborah Gonzalez is not going to do that.
That's right. She's a much better manager, I think. You know, there are.
But she has no prosecutorial or even defense, criminal defense experience.
Really? Yeah.
So that may be an opening for somebody else to jump in. And I wouldn't be surprised if a Republican ran too, because it is also a Coney County.
It is a Coney County. Right.
And I would not be surprised if there were not more people coming in. But I'm hoping that they really recognize, like, if we're going to build the new judicial center, then this is an excellent opportunity to create a center that is designed to serve the people that are going through the system rather than just the system. And that's what we have now.
And another longtime legal person, Oconee County Sheriff Scott Berry, says he's retiring. And one of the candidates running to succeed him is former UGA Police Chief Jimmy Williamson. Now, if he wins, he'd be the second former UGA police chief in Oconee County government.
After Chuck Horton.
Yeah. Right.
Well, this has been a long time coming. Sheriff Berry's been pretty open that this was going to be his last term. And I think as soon as actually in the news release announcing his retirement from UGA, Jimmy Williamson said that he was going to run for sheriff of Oconee County.
I think he did.
You know, like 2 years ago.
Right.
So.
Yeah.
But there is another candidate, and I'm struggling to remember his name, but there is somebody else who's announced. And
Captain James Hale is also running.
Okay, so he's with the sheriff's office currently?
Right.
Okay.
So he's running.
And so
Blake,
I guess he would be Scott Berry's successor.
That's status quo.
Yeah, I know that Lee Becker at Oconee County Observations, who does an excellent job covering Oconee County, is posted about how Jimmy Williamson has some views that, you know, he's criticized Scott Berry for his social media presence, which I think anyone who's been on Facebook and follows the Oconee County Sheriff's Office knows that they have a tendency to maybe step over the line every once in a while.
A lot.
Especially on racial issues, but they've gotten some criticism for that. And he had some interesting comments on guns, too. He's not in favor of campus carry or, you know, and he thinks that people who own guns should be required to have training, which I think is a very common sense point of view, but I don't know if it's one that's going to fly in Oconee County.
You know, it'll be interesting because Jimmy Williamson really was, when he was at UGA, he was a very careful with students, very understanding, was flexible in handling things. I felt like that he took a very considerate approach to people who were encountering the law enforcement. And it'll be interesting if people buy that for the kind of tough, you know, we're going to get them all attitude that Scott Berry has always had, talking about the old school and the new. This is another example of that.
Yeah, times are changing. We'll see if they're also changing in Oconee County.
Now, in Flagpole, last week, you guys reported that Williamson is actively courting Democrats, even though he said he will run as a Republican. Does he have appeal to cross party lines, do you think?
I would think so, yeah. The question is, what else is going to be on the ballot? are there going to be any Democratic primaries that Democrats are going to be interested in voting in? If there aren't, then I could certainly see some Democrats possibly crossing over. There'll be a U.S. Senate race, so that will probably discourage some folks from pulling a Republican ballot.
All right. Well, we're about out of time on that, so I do want to thank my panel for joining me today. That's Blake Odd with Flagpole, Gwen O'Looney with WXAG, and Chris Dowd, our politics nerd.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us.
Americans continue to try to make sense of three mass shootings in the last 2 weeks in Gilroy, California, Dayton, Ohio, and El Paso, Texas. Addressing the nation on Monday morning, President Trump talked about hate groups, white supremacy, and a culture of violence, especially violent video games.
We must stop the glorification of violence in our society. This includes the gruesome and grisly video games that are now commonplace.
Meanwhile, the hashtag video games are not to blame was trending on Twitter by midweek. Here to help us understand the connection between pixelated violence and real-life mass shootings is Dr. Shira Chess, Associate Professor of Entertainment and Media Studies at UGA's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication, and the author of the book Ready Player 2, Women Gamers and Designed Identity. Welcome, Dr. Chess.
Thank you.
Well, let's begin with a rather broad question. I know we've been talking as a society about the links between video game violence and real-life aggression for years. What does the research say, though?
Most of the longitudinal studies do not show that relationship as being particularly compelling. There's not a lot out there that gives us a sense that there's a direct link between playing violent video games and being violent. Otherwise, we would have a lot more violence. There are a lot of people that play violent video games.
It seems like the discussions around video game violence are kind of one-dimensional in nature, but there's nuance to be considered here, right?
There's a lot of nuance in how we think about video games and violence, or how we should be thinking about video games and violence. Video games don't exist in a bubble. People don't play a video game and then immediately do the thing that they see, just like they don't watch television or see movies or read books and immediately do the thing that they are interacting with. That's not the way that media works. The reality, though, is that video games do exist in a larger ecosystem. And that ecosystem has had a complicated history that has tended towards people talking in violent ways. In particular, Gamergate 5 years ago, when that began, Gamergate was a hashtag movement where a lot of people in the industry and in gaming culture were being harassed for their identities. Gamergate showed us that there is a lot of hostility, there is a lot of aggression, but that doesn't make the two things causal. It makes it part of, again, this larger ecosystem, this larger conversation that we need to have. Rather than focusing on banning things, we need to focus more on media literacy.
Touching on one of your areas of expertise and the subject of your book, can you talk a little bit about the more violent video games? They tend to be mostly played by young males. There aren't as many women playing, say something like Call of Duty, for instance. Is that a function of just different interests, or is it a function of the marketing more specifically toward young men?
So all kinds of people play all kinds of things. And there are women that play more violent video games. There are men that play casual phone games. There's not necessarily this delineation that the market likes to make regarding that. However, the video game industry for a long time sort of looked at young men as sort of the bread and butter, right? Who was buying the most consoles? Who was buying the most games? And that sort of created this cycle where the same people were making games that they themselves would want to play rather than sort of branching out and coming up with new games. So there is a history in the video game industry of making games intended for a single audience. That said, that is changing a lot over the last decade. That has broken quite dramatically. Violent video games are only one aspect, one portion, one small sliver of what the market looks like. And if we keep having conversations only about video games in terms of the relationship to violence or addiction or toxicity, then we're going to miss out on the amazing, wonderful, beautiful experiences that games can offer us.
I also want to touch on the social nature of some games where there's real-time communication with other players, and that's sort of important to the success or the end result of the game. The social side of some games seems to be something we don't discuss too much, but do these in-game social networks have the potential to radicalize in any way or desensitize players as much of the game might do itself?
Yes, but no more than anything else. You can be radicalized in a face-to-face meeting. You can be radicalized in a forum online. You can be radicalized anywhere. It's a question of who you are and whether or not you are willing to be radicalized, right? And I'm not an expert on radicalization, so take that with a grain of salt. But I don't see video games as having any more or less potential for that. However, again, we have to view that question of violence as part of this broader ecosystem.
Earlier, you mentioned this focus, whether right or wrong, on the addictive nature of games. Is there any study you're aware of that looks at the effect of such activity on mental health?
You know, the World Health Organization has made a category for video game addiction. I think that came out last year. And I'm somewhat dubious of that particular diagnosis, not to say there are people that have addictive personalities that tend towards certain kinds of psychological addictions. However, what I find is that most people, when they're talking about being addicted to a game, they're actually using the word addicted in place of the word enjoyable. Really usually doesn't mean that they have an actual addiction. That means that they really like playing it, and they might feel a little guilt about how much they like playing it. So if we take away that guilt, what does that look like? If you spent 2 hours a day reading a book, you wouldn't say, well, I have a novel addiction. Don't talk about other media like that. So a lot of this is based in moral panic of new kinds of media, which we see every time there's a new medium that happens in our culture. There's always a sense of moral panic, and video games have enjoyed that moral panic for quite some time now, and I don't imagine it's going away anytime soon, unfortunately.
Dr. Shira Chess is Associate Professor of Entertainment and Media Studies at the University of Georgia's Grady College of Journalism and Mass Communication, and the author of the book Ready Player Two: Women Gamers and Designed Identity.
Here's a statistic that might surprise you. Infant care in Georgia costs over $1,000 per year more than in-state college tuition. That's according to the Georgia Early Education Alliance for Ready Students, or GEARS. Recently, GEARS was in Athens talking with a group of elected officials, business people, and community leaders. Among those at the meeting was District 5 Commissioner Tim Denson, and he joins us now to talk about that discussion. It almost seems like a misprint when I read that childcare costs are higher than the cost of going to college for some state schools. That's such a chunk of your income, even if you're not low income. If you're
right.
Middle class, that's a struggle.
It's a real struggle. I mean, I am a part-time stay-at-home dad myself because having full-time childcare is not something that my family can afford. So we have part-time childcare, and the rest of the time, I'm the one staying at home, and it's a fantastic thing to be able to do, but it makes it difficult, makes it challenging, and we have a lot of parents that I think that face that challenge. It's a huge burden, and it's one that's has, in a lot of ways, a larger impact on the entire family than, say, going to college does, because at that point, when you're going to college, of course, your child has a lot of independence, is able to do things by themselves. When you talk about the childcare part, I mean, you're having to find somebody that can change their diaper, get them dressed, feed them, find the right food, make sure that they're constantly overseeing them. So this very pivotal part of their development in their life. And we talk about the it's now more expensive, but then we also look at how childcare is treated and invested in. And that's the big problem here, because whenever you talk to any kind of specialist on this, they'll tell you that those first 4 years of a child's life is the most impactful. It needs the most care, the most nurturing. Yet the people who do that nurturing, childcare professionals, are basically the lowest paid individuals when it comes to actual education. We really need to be looking at how we're prioritizing things, how we're investing in the well-being of human beings.
As we mentioned earlier, GEARS was in town recently, and what was the focus of that meeting here in Athens?
Yeah, Georgia Early Education Alliance for Ready Students, this great organization that's really focusing on early education and childcare in Georgia. And they had a focus here on Athens, specifically how it's affecting our economy and what the current state of childcare is here. And I think one of the biggest, most shocking things, I think a lot of people maybe don't realize, especially if you don't have children at this time of that age, we have 6,839 children under the age of 5. Yet the amount of childcare slots for licensed childcare facilities and childcare homes is
2,217.
Wow.
Only a third of what of the students we have here. Yet, 65% of that 6,800, 65% of those kids have both parents working.
What were some of the things that they suggested?
Some of the things that we've been talking about, and this has been going on in Envision Athens too, has been getting employers more involved in childcare. We actually have some great employers here in Athens that are already doing this, that that offer subsidies for their childcare or have childcare offered like within the business that the employees work at. So doing that, obviously increasing funding however we can, trying to draw down more funding from the state if we can. That's been happening a little bit, but we need to really increase that. And this is what I'm excited about, of course, my role, is finding out how the county government could be stepping in and doing some interesting things. And that's why with the SLOS list that we just passed last month, I worked to get childcare facilities mentioned as part of the Classic Center Arena project and also the space modernization project so that we can have a childcare facilities close to downtown around over in East Athens that we could use to help obviously increase that capacity first of all and make sure that people who are visiting those businesses have childcare provided to them. And also people in those nearby communities, especially if we're able to figure out ways to subsidize that, can have affordable childcare at these quality institutions.
Tim Denson is an Athens Clark County Commissioner representing District 5.
Lots of people take advantage of the summer months to do more reading, perusing mysteries, thrillers, history, romance, and the like. But a few dozen Athenians spent their summer plowing through nearly 500 pages of dry, dusty legalese, and they say they're glad they did. Our senior producer, Martin Matheny, sat down to talk to a few of them.
Two volumes, four appendices, 448 pages. The report by former special counsel Robert Mueller isn't exactly a pleasurable beach read, but over the summer, dozens of people from Athens and around Northeast Georgia met nearly every Sunday at the Athens-Clark County Library to read and discuss the Mueller report. I sat down to talk to a few of them, Laura Driscoll, Amy Ross, and the group's moderator and facilitator, UGA PhD student Shelby Stewart. Let me start with the most obvious question. Why read the Mueller report?
Well, I'm a citizen, and I care about the political atmosphere in the country, and I have actually experience from my research around the world, investigating truth commissions and their reports. And so for me, reading the report was essential in order to understand what was being presented to the public and why.
I read it for similar reasons, although after seeing Mueller speak before a congressional group several weeks ago, he expected us as citizens to simply read the document. And rather than rely on even the best reporting, I was going to learn it by reading it myself.
Staying with you for a second, Laura, how difficult was it to plow through this report? I mean, it's dense.
Well, although it's 480 pages, so much of it is footnoted and a lot of it is redacted. So it goes quickly and it's extremely well written. And the only section that was a little difficult for those of us not legally trained was the very last section on the president's defense of his positions in this whole matter.
I want to jump to you, Shelby, the group's moderator and facilitator. Were you happy with the turnout to these discussion group meetings?
Absolutely. I was quite surprised that we created a Facebook event and we only got maybe 20 RSVPs on that. So that first week especially, I was expecting maybe 12 people and just having a really small discussion. And then when we had over 60 or maybe even 65 people show up that first week, I was definitely a little bit intimidated just as a moderator, but also I was just so excited to see how many people were interested, and we kept that turnout high throughout the entire 7 weeks.
Amy, there was a time not too long ago, even really to a certain extent now, you couldn't open up a newspaper or turn on cable news without hearing about the Mueller report. So what did you learn from the report that isn't being covered on the news?
What was most interesting for me, or what I learned in this particular session, was actually hearing the discussion of my community members and hearing what other people thought of it and asking the different kinds of questions that we were going through.
All right. That was Laura Driscoll and Amy Ross, two members of the Mueller Report Discussion Group, sponsored by WUGA and the Athens-Clark County Library. Also, Shelby Stewart, a UGA PhD student in political science and the group's moderator. For WUGA, I'm Martin Matheny. Thank you.
This is Athens News Matters from WUGA. I'm Chris Shoup.
And I'm Alexia Ridley. Canadian pianist Paul Bley died in 2016, but a recent release of a date from years ago shows him in an intimate concert with a trio. John Slights has this review.
Canadian pianist Paul Bley was a musical pioneer who constantly challenged the boundaries of what could and could not be played in jazz. That's Bley soloing on the standard All the Things You Are from the 1962 album Sonny Meets Hawk by Sonny Rollins and Coleman Hawkins. Legendary jazz musician Pat Metheny described Bley's solo here as the shot heard around the world. Indeed, much of that solo foreshadows Bley's interest in free jazz, a genre that he would champion over the course of his life. As Bley aged, his status as a legendary improviser grew. By the time of Bley's death in January 2016 at the age of 83, his legacy was cemented as one of the jazz world's greats. That brings us to June of 2019, when ECM Records, Bley's longtime record label, released an archival concert performance from Bley's trio. Entitled When Will the Blues Leave, it was recorded in Switzerland in 1999. The date also features longtime collaborator Gary Peacock on upright bass and one of Bill Evans' drummers of choice, Paul Motion, behind the kit. You're listening to Mazatlan, the opening number of the performance. It's an up-tempo number. Motion's brush playing drives the tune. And while the metaphor of jazz as a conversation is trite, the improvisational nature of the piece does feel like a conversation in an intimate way that even few great improvisers always capture. After playing a set of original compositions, the trio closed the performance with two covers. The first, When Will the Blues Leave, is a 1958 Ornette Coleman composition. It also happens to be the title track of the disc. Bley recorded the tune for the first time in 1962 on his album The Floater Syndrome. Here, he gives Motion and Peacock plenty of opportunities to put their stamps on the piece. Perhaps it's only fitting to close the evening with a Bley solo interpretation of the Gershwin standard I Loves You, Porgy. For me, this is the highlight of the disc. It's also one of two solo pieces Bley performs during the concert. Bley makes this composition his own. The melody of the tune remains intact, but Bley adds flourishes and phrases that make the work distinctly his. It's an incredibly poignant way to conclude the evening's entertainment. Throughout this performance, it's clear that we, the listeners, are sitting in on three master musicians at work. Bley audibly sings and hums as he plays throughout the concert, giving us a rare glimpse into the creative process of a master improviser hard at work. The Swiss audience is largely silent throughout the performance, with only subdued applause at the end of each piece. However, it is abundantly clear that this is not due to a lack of interest. Indeed, it is nearly impossible not to be interested in what these masters are creating. The only question left to be asked is what took ECM so long to release it? For WUGA, I'm John Slights.
Finally today, the University of Georgia is about to welcome the bulk of its student body back to Athens, including some 5,700 first-year students. WUGA's Robin Whetstone got to the bottom of some UGA-specific mysteries.
From the window of an Orbit bus, UGA looks just like any other institution of higher learning. But I've always suspected that there's a different, more mysterious landscape just below the surface. The sign on the Meat Sciences Laboratory building, for example, over on South Campus, the one that says meat sale today. The idea of a meat lab having a meat sale seems unwise, sort of like a porta potty company that also sells bottled water. Why would anyone buy meat from a place that proudly admits to tampering with it before they sell it? I call them up to get to the bottom of things. The receptionist tells me about the meat they sell there and their hours, 10 to 4:30 every Friday. Then I hit her with the question. So, is the meat more or less expensive because of the experiments? No, says the secretary emphatically. No, they don't do experiments on the meat they sell. Let me let you talk to the manager. Hello, I say once the manager gets on the line. Your receptionist tells me you don't experiment on any of the meat you sell to the public. Well, sometimes we do, he replies. Aha, I yell. He's unfazed. Yeah, for instance, we found a local distillery that brews alcohol and fed the waste from the brewing process to the cows. So you could see what cows do when they're drunk, I said. What? No, no drunk cows. The alcohol burns off when it's cooking. It's just grain. It did just as well as corn. Oh, I say, disappointed. Yeah, all the meat we sell is USDA-approved, high-quality meat, just like in the store. Nobody's gonna glow from this meat. I hang up the phone and drive myself and my toddler down to the next landmark on my mental map of weird UGA. I push my toddler stroller into the lobby and speak with the lady behind the front desk. I tell her I want to know what the building is all about, and then, shy all of a sudden, I admit that I'm curious about the name. It was named for two coaches with great records at UGA, says the lady, Wallace Butts and Henry Mir. Yes, but, I lean closer, the name is kind of, funny. How so, she asks. Well, you know, Buttsmear. Say it out loud. Buttsmear. Buttsmear? Repeats the lady. Yes, Buttsmear. Buttsmear, Buttsmear, Buttsmear. I realize that I am standing with my toddler in the lobby of a fancy building yelling Buttsmear over and over at someone I've only just met and feel ashamed. Is there anyone else I could talk to about this? The lady at the desk refers me to the office manager of the sports communications division. She tells me about all of the exciting things to see in the building's museum, which is free and open to the public Monday through Friday from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Okay, I say, but what about the name? Butts Mayor, she pronounces. What about it? Butts Mayor, I'm taken aback. Butts Mayor, that's how you pronounce it? Yes, says the manager. What about it? Ah, I stammer. I thought it was pronounced Buttsmear, and I thought that was kind of, unusual. Nope, says the manager, looking at me placidly. It's Butts Mayor. Butts Mayor. So, the meat lab is not selling dangerously adulterated products, and the Buttsmear building is actually the Buttsmear building, which is not really hilarious or unusual at all. I feel deflated. Suddenly all the whimsy has flown from my alma mater. Perhaps I'm due for some quiet reflection time in the quiet reflection room. It's on the third floor of the Tate Student Center, and I used to think it was odd that a place like that would have such a room, and funny that there was a sign there explicitly forbidding studying. But now I'm sure there's a good explanation.
That piece was produced by WUGA's Robin Whetstone, and it originally appeared in Flagpole magazine in 2013. Flagpole is an underwriter of WUGA.
And speaking of underwriters, one of the hospitals we mentioned earlier in the show, St. Mary's Hospital, is also an underwriter with WUGA. This has been Athens News Matters from WUGA. Our senior producer is Martin Matheny, and our segment producers are Alex Vandenhoevel and John Slights. The opinions expressed on the program do not necessarily reflect those of WUGA or the University of Georgia.
Don't forget, if you missed part of this week's show, you can listen again online at wuga.org. For Alexia Ridley, I'm Chris Shoup, and this has been Athens News Matters from WUGA News.